Welcome to The World Below, The War in the Heavens, a podcast exploring the adventure, the intrigue, and the magic of a land that lies beneath the celestial battle between gods and demons, a clash that has gone on since time immemorial. I'm your guide, your interlocutor, and your host, Michael Pryor. Welcome, everyone, to episode 26 of The World Below, The War in the Heavens podcast, the sixth of season three. This one is all about the Demon Temple. It's time for one of our thematic episodes on The World Below, The War in the Heavens podcast, mainly because this extraordinary development doesn't fit neatly into the reign of a single monarch. It's a meaty religion, politics, and personalities mix, and it truly deserves an episode all of its own. And the title of the episode so readily suggests itself that it's perfect. So get ready for episode 6 of season 3 of The World Below, The War in the Heavens podcast, The Demon Temple. The Overview. The short story is that ecclesiasts from the prime temple in the city of Anarchist travel into the vast interior of the continent and set up what you might call a branch temple, which begins to develop very strange characteristics and eventually becomes threatening enough that the prime temple embarks on a holy war against it, only to be defeated in remarkable circumstances. A few years after this, this breakaway demon temple is destroyed in a magic conflagration, the like of which had never been seen before and has never been seen since. And yes, that's some overview. Let's get into the details. The period we're talking about here begins roughly in the middle of the reign of Yefan the Bloody in the year 386, and it begins normally enough, even unobtrusively, given the chaos and bloodshed that was going on in Anarchist at the time, the nightmare years being in full swing. The accepted story is that a group of committed ecclesiasts from the prime temple in Anarchist set off with missionary zeal to establish a branch temple in the wilderness, somewhere where their charitable work and dedication to the cause would be doing more good than in the established community that was Anarchist. By this time, the fourth century since the founding of Anarchist, the prime temple was well established and had entered a definite phase of expansion, if you like. If it was a business, you'd say that it had got over the start-up years and was ready to spread its wings and consolidate its position in the market. Not willing to rely on the natural spread, it encouraged ecclesiasts to go out into the world and found branch temples. Especially in these early years, the prime temple was willing to back these brave souls with money and resources. It's worth noting that it's been said that by this time, after a few hundred years of domination in the capital of Anarchist, that the prime temple was a difficult place to find advancement, especially for young and up-and-coming ecclesiasts. Instead of labouring for decades and hoping that someone in a prize position managed to die, many ambitious young ecclesiasts chose to take up the offer of the temple elders and head out and make their mark somewhere else, either to become a big fish in a small pond, or to become so big in a regional sense that a return to the capital wasn't out of the question. Making your mark elsewhere than in Anarchist was something that looked good on the ancient ecclesiastic equivalent of a CV, and over the years a number of prime ecclesiasts spent time away from Anarchist before returning and manoeuvring through the halls of power. In this year of 384, the small band of ecclesiasts we're interested in set out for the interior of the continent. It wasn't the only party that year. And in fact, the nightmare years saw quite an exodus of young ecclesiasts from the capital. Getting away from Anarchist was generally a good idea at the time, and if you could hold up your hand and saying you were on a mission from the gods, no one could criticise. The leader of this small band was Lacidas Imogen. His background is obscure, but many ecclesiasts at the time came from obscure backgrounds, the prime temple being a useful place to direct younger children of noble households, the ones who had no possibility of inheritance, but also for foundlings and orphans from all sorts of families who could see no possibility of keeping a child. Like the Hypogeum, the Prime Temple served as a societal melting pot to some extent. In the junior-junior ranks, where this mix of backgrounds was commonplace, at least. Of course, even youngest children of noble households effectively abandoned to a religious order often managed to lord themselves over the rest of the novices. One way or another, they managed to have cells that were just a little better furnished than the cells of the rest of the novices, a little bit more comfortable, and if they were delivered an occasional shipment of food that was better than the standard fare, then it was only their due, wasn't it? Lacetus Imogen's background is notably obscure. Regardless, from an early age, he showed that combination of ambition and leadership that made him stand out. In the rough-and-tumble games that were common for the novices, he was either directing and strategizing or in the thick of it, throwing himself into the fray with notable bravery and a lack of care for his own bodily welfare. In his studies, he was also remarked upon, highly competitive and prepared to put in many extra hours to ensure that he'd top each class. Imogen was only in his early 20s when he led the band of ecclesiasts into the wilderness. His companions were mostly from a solid core of friends and followers he'd developed in his late teens, youngsters who were both keen and happy to leave the somewhat stultifying and worrying surroundings of Anarquist. With a small chest of gold from the temple coffers, the party struck out for the most challenging part of the continent. By this time, the 4th century since the founding of Anarquist, it had become clear that what had been thought of as an empty wilderness in the centre of the continent was in actuality far from that. While much of it was indeed a hostile desert in many ways, it was big enough to include some areas where people lived, either gathered around permanent springs or in secluded river valleys, or around the far-flung ancient and well-rounded mountain ranges and the subsequent rivers that went with them. These communities, settlements, small towns, call them what you will, were scattered far and wide and had little communication with each other, let alone the cities that had grown up in more hospitable climes nearer the coast. The isolation actually appealed to many, though, especially those who might be said to have unconventional ways of life or belief. In their remoteness, they felt safe from censure and able to live the sort of life they chose. Imogen had declared before leaving Anarquist that his mission was to set up a branch of the temple in the remotest of locations in order to serve these unfortunates, to help them better understand their relationship with the war in the heavens and to bring to them basic help in the form of medicine and modern agricultural methods that the temple had pioneered across the more fertile areas of the continent. Many months of travel, and some travail, ensued in an epic journey that's probably worth an episode of its own. Among other adversities, the party had to cross river deep, mountain high. Several of his band perished due to the hardships they endured, most notably in an encounter with a pair of the giant flightless but carnivorous birds that the party blundered upon while nesting. Three of Imogen's loyal followers died before the party managed to escape from the creatures, but scattered as they were, it took some weeks, and one more death from thirst, before the party was reunited. Eventually, Lacetus Imogen led the party to a relatively comfortable area at the southwest end of the Calyx Mountains, a straggly mountain range on the edge of the harsh and unforgiving limestone desert that stretches for hundreds of miles. A small settlement had grown around a number of permanent springs there, and the area even had an intermittent watercourse, a river that flowed to the south before giving out onto what was a large salt lake, only full of water when the north of the continent was flooded and the waters eventually made their way south. The people who lived in this oasis of greenery were initially suspicious of the ecclesiasts. They were from many backgrounds and had learned to live in easy peace with each other and enjoying the desirable location. They saw the ecclesiasts as interlopers, if not intruders. Eventually, though, the ecclesiasts asked for nothing and helped wherever they could and were accepted into the small community. In fact, their presence helped the community grow when the word spread that included in this small group of missionaries were some with knowledge of medicine and healing, and others who were well-versed in agriculture, and a few who were experienced with the practicalities of building. The first building the ecclesiast made, of course, was the place of worship, a small stone-walled and reed-thatched temple. With intensive growing of crops in the small, fertile and watered area they found themselves in, the ecclesiasts were soon able to make their own beer, which endeared them even more to the locals. The word soon spread. The temple in the wilderness, as it was initially known, soon became the name of the community and became a very desirable stopping point for any travellers crossing the inland for whatever purpose. So far, so good. This was a pattern which had been well established even in these early days of recorded history in the world below the war in the heavens. Standard operating procedure, if you like. Set up a temple somewhere where there wasn't one, entrench it in the local community through good works, don't make much of a fuss, don't make demands, don't act as if the temple rules, and gradually the people will see the benefits of being on side with an organisation that has a long arm, with benefits that can flow from wealthier parts to less well-off parts. Then, rinse and repeat. And that's how the story went with the temple in the wilderness. Imogen showed fine leadership and organisational skills and was soon the de facto leader of the entire settlement, with the people deferring to him on most decisions. For nearly 20 years, the growth of the temple in the wilderness was solid, but not spectacular. It was prominent, however, in that it was the only temple for many, many hundreds of miles. So, if you like, it didn't have a lot of competition. It thrived, and the community thrived with it. A major turning point occurred in either 411 or 412 in the reign of Queen Kheska, records being inexact about this sort of thing for reasons which will become obvious later. A traveller, grateful for the accommodation and, legendarily, the beer, left a heavenly artefact with Imogen not as payment but as an expression of both gratitude and piety. The story goes, and story it is, as there's no actual evidence for this. Rather, it's pieced together, part of the whole story of the demon temple, handed down through generation, that this artefact was a single scale the size of a wagon wheel, exquisite in all ways and imbued with extraordinary power. The traveller had found it almost by accident, his dog scratching at the base of a lone, gnarled tree in an otherwise treeless waste. Realising the value of his find, he was on his way to Anaquis to cash in, but instead was overwhelmed with religious fervour and left the find to the temple in the wilderness. Imogen did what all leaders of new branch temples were meant to do in such circumstances. He sent the find to the prime temple in Anaquis. He entrusted it to his most worthy lieutenant and a good troop of volunteer guards from the local community. After another perilous journey that would deserve its own episode as well, they were successful and returned with funds from the grateful prime temple. The funds were allocated to the building of a larger and better temple, and suggestions from the hierarchy that a vault be part of this new, bigger temple to store such heavenly artifacts that could be found in the wilderness prior to conveying them to the prime temple. This second phase of the temple in the wilderness, after the establishment years of the first phase, saw it become a major repository and trading outpost for the trade in heavenly artefacts. At first it was prospectors, individuals who thought that donating the odd minor artefact to the local temple would stand them in good stead in their future delvings, the heavens being on side, thanks to their generosity. Then small traders saw the opportunity to buy such items, becoming a sort of halfway house, and then they'd take their wares to larger centres to realise a profit. Like begets like. Competition brings about competition, and soon the outpost that was the temple in the wilderness was growing, with services expanding to support the trade in artefacts and scales and the increased population. Genuine caravans began plying the route between the temple in the wilderness and more settled towns and cities. The job of civilising the wilderness was well underway. Sometime during this period, Lacedaemon Imogen established a temple guard. While not a regular part of temple outposts, a temple guard was certainly not unknown, especially in more hostile surroundings. with a commander recruited from Anaquist itself, the Temple Guard of the Temple in the Wilderness soon established itself as a place for ambitious young people from the locality to learn skills, and not just in warfare and logistics. The Temple Guard kept the peace in and around the temple itself, and they protected any valuables that the temple possessed, and soon they took on the role of what you might call community policing, keeping the peace and sorting out misdemeanors. An unspoken role of the Temple Guard of the Temple in the Wilderness was to defend the community if raiders came, which happened now and then, especially once the community was seen as relatively prosperous. Many a recruit to the Temple Guard who braved these assaults went on to seek higher positions elsewhere on the continent as an experienced soldier. The development of the Temple in the Wilderness follows a pattern that was repeated many times across the continent. This is one of the earliest, and certainly at this time one of the most successful, and it would have stood as a useful model if not for the death of Lacidas Imogen in 447, when he was somewhere in his 50s. Now, the death of a leader of an ecclesiastic community in those days usually meant some sort of a conclave among the more senior ecclesiasts on a site whereupon a new leader would be appointed either through consensus or some form of a vote. And here's a point where the story of the temple in the wilderness diverges from the norm. Lacidas Imogen had children, twins who were born on the arduous journey from Anaquist back in 384. From an early age he taught them and had the expectation that they'd follow in his footsteps to lead the temple in the wilderness. This sort of dynastic passing of leadership has never been an accepted part of temple tradition. But this is where Lacidas Imogen showed his most unconventional side. He raised the twins, Zolta and Polcastenes, with the expectation that they would take over upon his death. And they were touched with religious zeal and saw it as their destiny. They were ambitious and zealous, a combination that can lead to great things in one way or another. Unfortunately, these senior ecclesiasts in the temple in the wilderness didn't see it that way. They spurned Imogen's plan and appointed one of their own to lead the community. The twins, in their early 20s now, immediately left the temple in the wilderness, much as their father had left Anaquist at the same age. They pressed into the wilds of the inland, spending 6 years among the desert-dwelling folk, and also in exploring and developing a unique sense of this punishing, sun-baked world. They shared water with prospectors, visionaries, self-appointed prophets, and minor warlords, and they saw themselves as inheritors not just of a single temple, but of the entire interior of the continent. What brought Zolta and Polcastenes back to the community of the temple in the wilderness was an extraordinary find. Many times in their journeying, they had been in danger of dying of thirst, but as they became more experienced in making their way through this arid landscape, they learned where to find water in the most unpromising locations. On this occasion, they were digging to one side of a small, meagre outcrop of rock, understanding that water would have gathered at some depth below the surface. Before they struck water, however, they uncovered a heavenly artifact, a scale the size and shape of a lily pad. It was black, but shot through with veins of throbbing red and orange. Polcastenes, who had a touch of percipience, declared it was of exceptional power, but of a kind he'd never encountered before. He recoiled from it and was certain that it should be buried and the location forgotten. But Zolta convinced him otherwise. Zolta insisted that this treasure needed to be brought back to the temple in the wilderness. He was convinced that it would announce that they were ready to assume senior positions in the ecclesiastical hierarchy there. Thus, the first demon scale came to the temple in the wilderness. Their return was greeted with great fanfare and celebration, and the heavenly scale they brought with them was the object of much awe. A special side shrine was constructed inside the temple to house this remarkable find, and crowds flocked to view it, bringing donations and patronage to the temple in the wilderness. Very soon after this, the serving senior ecclesiast stood down in favour of the twins taking joint leadership of the temple in the wilderness. Within a couple of months, however, the twins declared that such a holy object wasn't something to be gawked at by the masses. They closed it behind a special locked screen. They were able to do this because, upon their return to the community, they had quickly taken on much of the responsibilities that their father had destined them for. The twins began preaching in the temple, a practice that had been, up until that time, a sporadic event, quite often only undertaken when a visiting ecclesiast, with a reputation for being an entertaining speaker, dropped in. The twins, however, began to preach weekly in a double act, which began to become more and more apocalyptic, if you like. As an aside, their religion in the world below the war in the heavens is necessarily apocalyptic when you think about it, when just about anybody can look up now and then and see that there's a real battle going on in the heavens and that it's a classic good guys versus bad guys situation. It's not hard to come to the conclusion that it's an apocalypse they were talking about. Given that, it's interesting to see how relaxed the temple generally has been over its couple of millennia of existence. I suppose that's because they don't have to try terribly hard to convert people. The evidence falls all around. It's almost as if they don't want to labour the point. The twins, Salter and Paul Castanese, broke the mould somewhat with long descriptions of the battle in the skies and what it meant for everyone on the ground below. At first, they attracted admirers, people who were fascinated by the back and forth between the twins, one being full of anger while the other soothed and blessed, only for the roles to be reversed moments later. Stories come down to us of the flashing eyes and the thrall in which congregations were held. During this time, no one apart from the twins themselves was able to view the artifact that the twins had found. It came to a point where the twins announced that the temple in the wilderness would no longer accept or pay for any heavenly artifact apart from those of the same nature as the one they had brought out of the desert. For these, they would pay a premium. And if anyone tried to sell such a thing to anyone but them, it would be confiscated by the temple guard. This caused some consternation, but it was soon overcome when the traders were happy to fill the void that the temple left, and prospectors went directly to them with no fear of disapproval. Initially, it made little difference to the prospectors, but a few of the more canny soon discovered that making the extra effort to find these unusual scales was more than worth it. The twins paid outrageous sums without argument, and soon the number of these strange scales that were brought into the temple in the wilderness meant that a special, large, extremely well-constructed vault needed to be erected to cope. Lucrative though it might be, finding and bringing these eerie scales to the temple in the wilderness wasn't without peril. Braving the desert in search of any sort of heavenly artifact was dangerous, but it began to be understood that these odd scales had risks in themselves. Some prospectors who found them sickened and died. Others went mad. Some lost limbs, hands, fingers, and it soon became common knowledge that handling these weird scales was bad practice indeed. Leather gloves, at the very least, were needed, and some of the more brave or more foolhardy prospectors went about with mail gauntlets over leather gloves. None of this, though, seemed to apply to the twins. Each time one of the scales was presented to the temple in the wilderness, they would accept it with due ceremony, passing it between them and finally each bestowing a kiss on the scale before taking it to join the others accumulating in the vault. Also, the twins took to spending much time in the vault. It was around this time that the ecclesiasts in the temple in the wilderness started adopting distinctive silvery robes made from wool and dyed with the crushed shells of land crabs that were common in the area, a dye for which the recipe has been lost since the land crabs went extinct. Word of the unconventional approaches of the temple in the wilderness made their way to the prime temple in Anaquist. Unconventional, you have to understand, isn't a word that's popular with most religions, and the temple was no different. After all, unconventional isn't far from unorthodox, and then it's a short hop to dissenting, and after that, heretical is just around the corner. The Prime Temple sent a delegation, ostensibly a goodwill, fact-finding mission, but actually to find out what was going on with the twins and these strange scales they were collecting. Not all of the delegation returned. In fact, only their heads did, piled in a cart and driven by the youngest and luckiest member of the delegation. A letter from the twins accused the Prime Temple of blasphemy, sacrilege, and violation of everything the religion ever meant. A preemptive strike, if there ever was one. Reluctantly, the Prime Temple sent a contingent of mercenaries to deal with the twins. It was ambushed and massacred by force made up of the Temple Guard from the temple in the wilderness and hundreds of desert warriors who'd been recruited to the cause. Left with no choice, the Prime Temple declared a holy war and levied every realm across the continent for commanders, troops, and supplies. Not wanting to make the same mistake twice, instead of sending a small force, this time the Holy Army was enormous. The usual stories have been handed down about the column of infantry taking days to pass a certain town, or of dust storms thrown up by the passing of cavalry. Dust storms that turned day into night, that sort of thing. It took 6 months for the Holy Army to be assembled, and then to traverse the hundreds of miles to confront the temple in the wilderness. Modern scholars hazard guesses like 50,000 individuals, but that's what they are, guesses. In the meantime, the twins hadn't been idle. A wall had been built around the community and fortifications added, which made the task of bringing the recalcitrants to heel less straightforward than it had promised. The commanders of the Holy Army made the usual approaches, offering clemency and a chance to surrender, but these were rejected. As is also usual with army commanders, some were no doubt pleased about this and about having the chance to go into battle, while others, perhaps more experienced, were heavy-hearted. The Holy Army advanced, not bothering with the business of besieging the community, and instead assuming that their vastly superior numbers meant that a frontal assault would get the job over and done with quickly. Bad idea in so many ways. Strange devices were quickly brought up onto the ramparts as the Holy Army advanced, and when the troops were within a stone's throw, pandemonium erupted. Again, lack of records and all of that, but the tradition is that these devices were constructed on the orders of the twins, and they harnessed demon scales. No one by this time was under any illusion that the objects from above that the twins were collecting were anything else than demon scales. Records from the Prime Temple tells us that the commanders of the Holy Army were apprised of this before they left, that the chief ecclesiasts in the Prime Temple were afraid of them and what they meant, hence the size of the Holy Army and the need to put an end to what the Imogen twins were doing. The confidence of the commanders of the Holy Army was shattered as the troops advanced. The devices rigged up on the walls spewed forth death. Some speak of great gouts of flame erupting from these devices. Others detail the various sorts of lightnings that rolled out, while others speak of advancing mists of acid. Where they are united is in the descriptions of the sound that erupted from these devices, a vast groaning boom like tortured thunder. The Holy Army was cut down in swathes, with even those few who managed to turn and start to run dying horrible deaths. Very few escaped to report to the Prime Temple in Aniquist, where the elders went into a state of paralysed panic, afraid and uncertain of what to do. For decades after this, the Demon Temple, for it was widely known as such, became something of a hermit realm. Only those who brought demon scales could expect anything less than immediate death if they fronted up to the gates. Despite the danger, demon scales continued to flow into the Demon Temple simply because the price paid was many times more than could be expected anywhere else. We do have one source from this time, a small book or long pamphlet called A Traveller Visits the Demon Temple by A Curious Wanderer, which is, let's say, a dubious text. Some say it's totally made up. Others think it's an amalgam of true traveller's tales and fantasy. Others think it's an authentic first-hand account. For what it's worth, this account speaks of everybody inside the walls wearing silver robes, as if the entire community was part of the temple. The curious wanderer even gives an account of the twins, who were in their late 50s by this time, giving one of their marathon sermons where they praised wickedness and excoriated pity, charity, and kindness. The sermon was said to have concluded with both twins hurling themselves on the floor and foaming at the mouth. The demon temple came to a sudden and devastating end in 414. The nearest town of any real size was 150 miles to the southeast, and on an early winter morning, the roof of every building in the town was ripped off. Shutters were torn off and trees were shredded, not by a storm, but by a sudden eruption of light to the northwest. It took days for the brave to travel in that direction, only to find that the entire community of the demon temple was gone, and in its place was a deep crater where all the sand thereabouts was transformed into something like sickly green glass. This crater is still there today, somewhat filled with wind-blown sand. Nothing grows in it, and nothing will grow for a mile or so around it. Animals and birds avoid it, and anyone foolish enough to visit is known to fall ill, and the closer they approach, the more serious their condition, with many perishing. The consensus is that the twins gathered so many demon scales and stored them in one place, and this made something happen. The exact mechanism is unknown, but the temple takes precautions these days and makes sure that no great number of demon scales are ever stored in the one place at the one time. And that's it for episode 27 of the World Below the War in the Heavens podcast. Coming up next, Queen Keska, the last monarch of the nightmare years. Until then, farewell, and may the heavens smile upon you. This has been The World Below the War in the Heavens, a podcast exploring the history, culture, and esoterica of the world below, a continent of magic and mystery with inhabitants who keep one eye on the sky at all times. I've been your host, Michael Pryor. If you'd like to find out more about me and my books, pop over to www.michaelpryor.com.au. Farewell.